from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Memorial Day was first conceived as Decoration Day after the Civil War, a day of remembrance of those who gave their lives in service to the country. We cannot speak to the dead, but their sacrifice speaks to us. And there is no greater symbol of courage and sacrifice in battle than the Medal of Honor. Americans for, in, and against war have sacrificed. But once the battle begins, all soldiers sacrifice. Many put themselves in harm's way. A tiny few are acknowledged for going above and beyond the call of duty, with the nation's highest award for bravery in battle, the Congressional Medal of Honor. General George Patton once remarked that he would give his soul to receive one. Most do. The great majority of Medal of Honor recipients have died in their act of extreme valor. And some survive. Tonight on Point, we'll hear their stories, the battlefield stories of Congressional Medal of Honor recipients. Joining me now from Washington is Larry Smith, former managing editor of Parade magazine and earlier an editor at the New York Times. He is author of Beyond Glory, Medal of Honor Heroes in Their Own Words. Smith interviewed 24 Medal of Honor recipients for the book. We will speak with one of them later in the hour, but I want to welcome first Larry Smith. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Larry, it's Memorial Day, a day for many kinds of thoughts on this particular day. But among them, we have to remember the courage and sacrifice of soldiers who are ordered to do what they do for the country. And above all, at least as honored by medals, the Medal of Honor singles them out for at risk of life, above and beyond the call of duty. I wonder if you can give us a little background on this medal, Larry, and how we came to have such a thing.
Well, curiously, the United States had no medals after the Revolutionary War, because our founding fathers were very much against the trappings of aristocracy. And there was one little purplish medal that George Washington created that was hardly ever awarded. And it wasn't until the Civil War that the Navy went to Abraham Lincoln and said, we'd like a medal to recognize conduct, you know, above and beyond. And so December of 61, the medal was signed into law. And then the other services soon each followed with their own similar design. And throughout the Civil War, I think something like 1,500 of the medals were awarded. And the requirement today, which is approximately the same then, was to earn the medal, one required a deed of personal bravery or self-sacrifice above and beyond the call of duty, as we all know. There have to be two key eyewitnesses. The action must be beyond the call of duty, and it has to be the sort of action that involved the risk of life and be the type of deed which, if you didn't do it, you would not be blamed for failing to do so.
Sort of the definition above and beyond.
That's it. Mm-hmm. And throughout the 19th century, that was about the only medal we had. And you find instances of where people would be receive the medal for jumping overboard to save someone who was drowning. And there was a woman nurse who received the medal for the Civil War. And actually, Buffalo Bill and some other folks got the medal who weren't really in the military. Come 1915, this whole thing got sorted out, and they reexamined the medal. Lincoln had promised a number of soldiers, if they would reenlist, they could have the medal, and by mistake, the whole regiment got the medal.
This was this the board, 27th Maine Infantry, 800-some guys.
That's it.
For not really having filled the intended definition of the
right.
Medal of Honor.
So
recipient.
It was all kind of reorganized and reestablished by this military board, and a number of medals were rescinded. The 27th Maine, those were rescinded. Mary Walker, the lady, lost her medal, and various others. And then the tiers of medals, as we understand them today, were created. And it was from that point on that the medal really began to acquire its cachet or distinction. And, in fact, it was in World War II when it really became significant.
We shouldn't skip over World War I, even though World War II is when it was elevated to the sort of rarefied height it's at now. But there's the famous story of Alvin York, the Tennessee Army sergeant in World War I, what killed 25 enemy, knocked out 35 machine gun positions, and captured 132 prisoners in one day, about a month before Armistice Day in 1918. Incredible story. Witnessed? Legitimate?
Absolutely. And I see you've done your homework. And York, of course, is one of the great ones. And I believe MacArthur's father had the medal. I think he might have received it twice. I'm not sure now.
Wow. So World War II is when the standards became much more stringent. Out of 13 million men that served in that war, as you write, only 433 received the medal, more than half of them killed in action. That's getting to be a very narrow eye of the needle for these winners.
It certainly is. In fact, I think I've been told that overall the posthumous rate is something like 68% of everyone who's received it. And today there are like 132 men left alive.
Larry Smith, you went out and talked with a couple of dozen of them. What was that experience like? Did you, when you sat down with Medal of Honor winners, still living, this is as of 2002 when you were doing these interviews, I guess, or most of them, were there character traits that you found in common to these men? I guess they were men.
Yes, indeed. I was receiving that question right from the beginning, and initially I didn't think they had much in common because these guys come from all walks of life. They're West Pointers or Annapolis grads. They're high school dropouts. Some are sharecroppers' sons. They're big, they're little, they're bright, they're everyday guys. But what I discovered once I got to talking with them was they shared what you might call true grit, determination. But the thing that struck me about them, all of them, especially coming from a corporate kind of position, which I had with the magazine, was I understood that the most valuable people were the ones who thought about somebody else first, mm-hmm. which is another way of saying duty. And the other thing about them was they're problem solvers, risk takers, and stubborn as all get out.
You describe this as being an honor that's given for something beyond glory. The recipients, most of them don't even like to be called winners because they've been put in circumstances it doesn't seem like winning on any count. But you say it's beyond glory, something about humility and a certain nobleness intended with the Medal of Honor.
They feel very strongly about that. Many of them don't feel they deserved it, and more than one tried to turn it down, such as Paul Buca from West Point, and they're finally prevailed upon to accept the medal as recognition of the service of the men around them, and they're very conscious of that today. They're a tight knit group. They belong to this Congressional Medal of Honor Society, and I wouldn't call them average men, but they're very normal, and they have this great kind of humility. They're very approachable, and one of the things that really surprised me was how forthcoming they were about their experiences.
You're right. They never sought recognition, yet it came to them, often inexplicably, in settings where men all around them were being slaughtered. And it's interesting to note that the Medal of Honor Society itself, one of its stated goals is to cease to exist in the hope that that would mean there was no more war.
Yeah, but they're certainly not counting on it.
Give us a sense of the range. What kind of activity, what kind of act on the battlefield draws a Medal of Honor?
Well, one of the most frequent types of award goes to medics. Because the medics get out there and risk their lives to pull injured off the battlefield under horrendous fire. So that's typical. In fact, the man we're going to talk to later, Al Roscone, was a medic.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, a lot of times, and this one also is confounding, guys jump on hand grenades. Hand grenades falls in the middle of a half a dozen guys, and one of them just jumps on it.
To save the others.
Yes. Yeah.
So that kind of sacrifice in both of those medics and jumping on a hand grenade. And then there's the going out and taking positions, going out and taking the enemy.
Let's talk a little bit about Daniel Inouye, the senator.
Yes, please.
He was 16 or so when Pearl Harbor was attacked, and he and his father went outside their home and watched the bombs dropping on Pearl Harbor, and they were appalled because they felt this was a reflection on them, and they considered themselves American citizens, and they were horrified by this whole thing. And of course, internship followed, 20,000 Japanese, and all the rest of it. And they prevailed upon President Roosevelt to allow them to create a battalion. And they shortly after they created this regimental combat team.
This all Japanese 442nd.
The 442, right. Mm-hmm. It was called the Go for Broke Battalion. That was a phrase that gamblers used in Hawaii when they were going to shoot the works, mm-hmm. Go for Broke. And this outfit of Inouye's ended up, and they fought exclusively in Italy. I guess they wanted to keep them away from the Japanese. Mm-hmm. But this outfit had something like 15,000 men go through 4,000 positions because of injury or death in combat.
All Japanese American.
This unit, this outfit won 8 presidential unit citations, 9,486 Purple Hearts, 4,000 Bronze Stars,
wow.
559 Silver Stars, and 33 Distinguished Service Crosses. No Medals of Honor until 2000, 60 years later, when the records were reexamined, and they ended up awarding 21 Medals of Honor. To guys who'd received the DSC. They were upgraded.
You're suggesting that because it was a Japanese-American unit, it may have been part of the reason that they didn't get Medals of Honor during World War II.
No question. I mean, there isn't any doubt about it. The same was true with the black, the 92nd Division and the other black soldiers who fought.
And we'll talk about that. But tell us the precise act of valor for which Daniel Inouye, among those, was given the Medal of Honor. What's the story there?
Well, the story's great. First of all, he was, the outfit was created. His father got the day off and rode with him in the streetcar to where he was going to be taken away for induction. And he said his father never talked, hardly. And they got getting close to where they were going, and his father cleared his throat and said, "America has been good to us. It has given me 2 jobs. It has given you and your sisters and your brother's education. We all love this country. Whatever you do, do not dishonor your country. Mm-hmm. Remember, never dishonor your family. And if you must give your life, do so with honor."
This is the father's message to his son. Then take us to the battlefield.
I hear
you choking up on that even now, Larry.
It gets me every time, I'm telling you.
And take us to the battlefield and moment when Daniel Inouye executed that performance.
He's leading a charge up against some machine gun nests, and he's leading his platoon. He's the leader, and they're flanking. And he liked to use hand grenades. He had a bag of hand grenades, like a school bag, and he took out 2 or 3 machine gun nests, and he was nearing the crest of the hill, had a grenade in his hand ready to throw, and an enemy soldier rolls up with a rifle grenade, and he fired this grenade at Inouye. And it hit him in the right arm and almost tore his arm off. Mm-hmm. It was just hanging in shreds. Mm-hmm. And he's standing there, and he's thinking, "Oh, my goodness, where's my grenade?" And he sees it hanging in his hand. It's still in his hand, in his fist.
In his destroyed
arm. And it's
cocked.
It's loaded. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so he reaches down with his left hand, pries his fingers loose, but flips the thing up and flips it into the other guy's foxhole, kills him, then picks up a Thompson submachine gun with his left hand and charges the enemy. Now, the interesting thing is that he has no recollection beyond that point, but all his people told him later what he did, and they couldn't believe he did all these things. Finally, he's shot in the leg, and he comes tumbling down the hill, and even then he won't let them take him away because he wants to position his men for the counterattack.
Just one story of a Medal of Honor winner, in this case, the U.S. Senator from Hawaii, Daniel Inouye. I'm talking tonight with Larry Smith, former managing editor of Parade magazine, author of Beyond Glory, Medal of Honor Heroes in Their Own Words. We're looking at the Congressional Medal of Honor and the stories of its recipients, awarded the medal for courage above and beyond the call of duty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Congressional Medal of Honor and the stories of its recipients awarded the medal for courage above and beyond the call of duty. My guest is Larry Smith, author of Beyond Glory, Medal of Honor Heroes in Their Own Words. He has interviewed 24 American Medal of Honor winners and collected their stories of valor in their own words, stories which he describes as pretty salty sometimes, funny, bawdy, you say, Larry. They still swore like the troopers they were many years later, but they didn't gild the lily. War is not pretty, and they didn't pretend that it was.
John Finn was about to have sex with his wife when they attacked Pearl Harbor, and he was really angry because it kind of got in the way of what was about to take place, and he tells it quite comically.
Well, that's above and
it's
beyond.
It's in the story.
I want to hear more and more stories because that really lays out what it is. I wonder if you'd tell us the stories of Walter Ehlers and Vernon Baker. Two different stories, but could you share those?
Well, that's great. I'd love to. I was going to volunteer Walter especially. I just love this guy. He was from Manhattan, Kansas, and his brother, Bud, joined the Army ahead of him before the Pearl Harbor, and he went to his mother and asked her if he could join, and she said she would sign for him if he would promise to be a Christian soldier. And anyway, he ends up fighting all through North Africa and Sicily with his brother. And then they go to England to train for the D-Day invasion. And about that time, the ship went down with these four Sullivan brothers who were all killed.
Mm-hmm,
and so any brothers were separated. And Ehlers' brother went into one company and he was in another. And come D-Day, which, you know, the invasion started at 6 a.m. We're mm-hmm. talking 60 years ago, you know, next week.
That's right.
And Ehlers was a squad leader. And a lot of folks don't know they used green troopers for the assault because they knew it was going to be so terrible, but they had veterans in charge. Walter had this squad, and they were getting such a pasting in the first wave that they sent in an interim group, which Walter said they called the Intermittent. And he led this squad of 12 kids ashore. And it was just like in the movies. I mean, this guy walks off the landing craft and sinks. He'd be short, and Walter reaches out and grabs him by the collar and marches him up on the beach. And all these guys are terrified. You know, they want to dig holes. And he says, "You can't stay here. We got to go.
Yeah.
You
got to
go." And he drives them up the beach. And miraculously, he and these 12 guys get to a shelter at the top of the beach without getting
unscathed,
scratched.
Under all that machine gun and mortar and artillery fire.
It's incredible. And there was a bunch of barbed wire there and a couple of guys with Bangalore torpedoes. It was just like that movie, Saving Private Ryan. Mm-hmm. In fact, I kind of suspect somebody read his story because a guy went out and got shot. Second guy gets the Bangalore in there, blows up the wire, and Walter leads his men charging up this path into all these trenches. And they end up taking out a German bunker, and for which he later received the Bronze Star. That was just for openers. Mm. And then he goes on up, and 5 or 6 days later, there's this fighting in the hedgerows where he performs the action that leads to his receiving the Medal of Honor.
And tell us about that. And as you do, Larry, tell us what it was about the action that sets it above the bronze, the silver, all the rest, and makes it Medal of Honor caliber.
Well, he went up into these hedgerows by himself and took out a number of machine gun nests, and he exposed himself in the open to pull men out of danger, and it was a series of activities, and of course he was shot himself, and he wouldn't leave the field. But the thing I wanted to mention, Tom, was an hour after Ehlers and his men crossed Omaha Beach, his brother landed with a second wave and was killed immediately.
Oh.
And Walter didn't even find out for 2 weeks. He said it was the worst day of his life. And he went on to earn 3 Bronze Stars, a Silver Star, the Medal of Honor, the British Military Medal, and 3 Purple Hearts. And he fought all through the war, came back, became a friend of John Ford, and got a part in a movie about West Point. He made $300 a week for 6 weeks.
John Ford, the famous filmmaker.
I ever made in my life.
What was his career apart from those 6 weeks, Walter?
A lot of medal recipients end up working for the VA, mm-hmm. and Walter spent most of his career in in the VA. His story is just extraordinary, and he's the nicest man. These guys get together once a year as a rule, and they go to high schools and they talk to the kids or junior colleges. And I heard Walter talking in one of these, and he said to these kids, and they're asking him about Omaha Beach. And he said, "Well, you saw that movie Saving Private Ryan?" Everybody says, "Yeah." He says, "Well, the real deal was 60 times worse than what you saw in that movie."
How about Vernon Baker, his story, a Buffalo
Vernon
soldier?
Vernon Baker, he's my personal hero. He was this little black kid from Cheyenne who got in a little bit of trouble, but he was smart and got through high school and was raised by his grandparents because his parents got killed in a car wreck. And he decides he's going to join the Army, and he shows up at the recruiting office in Cheyenne, and he said, this big old fat recruiting officer looked at me and said, "What do you want?"
This is in Wyoming.
Yes, in Wyoming, 1940.
Yeah.
He says, "What do you want?" He says, "I'd like to enlist." And the guy looked at him and said, "We ain't got no quotas for you people."
Ouch.
And he was devastated, of course. Yeah. And he went home and moped around the house. And his sister encouraged him to go back, and he did. And luckily, there was a new recruiting officer there. And he asked him what he wanted. Vernon said he wanted to enlist. And the guy's writing down all these answers. And Vernon said, what do you want to be in? And he says, "Well, I want to be in the quartermaster corps." And he said, "I was reading upside down and backwards, and I saw him write infantry," he said. "But I didn't care because I was in."
Mm-hmm.
So then he gets sent to Texas and barely escapes, serious injury through racism, because he thought he wasn't used to kowtowing to white folks.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he quit being a shoeshine boy and he quit working as a red cap because it consisted of too much guff from an unprintable word.
Yep.
And so he was an independent little cuss, and he turns out to be, he's the company clerk because he can write and he can do all these things. They make him an officer. The 92nd Division, this black division, gets reactivated and gets sent to Italy to fight alongside the 442. And I said to Vernon, I said, "Well, how did you get along with your soldiers in your platoon?" He was a second lieutenant. Mm. He said, "They thought I was a white man's nigger." He said, "They didn't want anything to do with me until we got aboard ship," he said. "Then I became mother, father, uncle, aunt to all of them," he said, "because I read all their letters to them and I wrote all their letters for them." So he gets control of this outfit, and then they end up in Italy and disproving, all the attitudes that were held about them. The prevailing opinion of the military at the time against black soldiers was terrible. And there's an excerpt about that in this chapter.
And we know that history, and it's hard history. Take us to that day on April 5th, 1945, where Vernon Baker then emerged. You'll tell us the story.
There's this huge assault is underway, and Vernon leads his platoon, and they're under command of a white officer.
Against German soldiers, and where is this, Larry?
This is in the coast. It's a place called Via Reggio on the west coast of Italy, about two-thirds of the way up the boot there. And there was a castle called Castle Aganolfi that was their objective. And these guys are going up. And, of course, it's hard to imagine, but you think of the dark and you think of all the explosions and all the racket. And Vernon loved the M1. He'd fooled with the other weapons, but he was a good shot because his grandpa had bought him this .22.
And describe an M1 and M1 to us.
The M1 Garand is a 30-06 military rifle that came into being in World War II, and it had an automatic clip. I think it was a 9-shot clip that ejected automatically when it was empty. But it had great stopping power. It wasn't light, but it was a very solid gun, and those who used it just swore by it. I made a point of asking these guys about these weapons as I talked to them. And then there's a picture of Vernon in the book with an M1 he has to this day. He keeps it loaded in his bedroom. It's cute as hell.
So take us into the detail of
all right.
Of that Vernon's moment
leading
that
these,
day.
Leading these guys up this hillside in the dark, and he sees these pipes out of the ground. He sneaks up. He realizes it's an observation post. He throws a couple of grenades in there. He takes those out. He takes out a couple of machine gun nests. And as he's walking along, he encounters all this yellow wire, rubberized wire, all mm-hmm. over the place. Mm-hmm. And just kind of as an afterthought, he carried these pliers in his, these wire cutters in his pocket, in his back off his hip for going through fences. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of absentmindedly takes out his clippers and cuts all these wires, which I think destroyed their communications. And his officer who was leading them disappeared. And Vernon finds himself up on the edge of this ravine, looking down and then up at the castle. And his white officer reappears. A guy comes out and throws a hand grenade at them and starts running. And the white officer disappears. And Vernon shoots the guy who threw the grenade, goes down into the ravine, finds a couple of bunkers, takes them out, comes back, and is reunited with this officer and his men. And the officer tells him he's got to go get reinforcements, and he's going to take this wounded guy back with him and basically leaves them there. And while he was up there, Vernon was calling for artillery, and the artillery people didn't want to fire because they didn't think a black platoon could be that far behind enemy lines.
They wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, but he finally prevailed upon them to do it, but he got it. So he's got his men up there, and here's a good answer to your question, Tom, because I said to Vernon, well, if your officer left, why didn't you guys get out of there?
Yeah,
and he said, I was just mad, and I wasn't going to leave just because he was leaving. He says it was stupid, I know, but we stayed, and so he's got these guys lined up, and some Germans come out with a Red Cross. And the blankets and everything, and this man want to shoot, and he says, hold on, and they pull the blanket off the stretcher, and there's a machine gun on there, so they blast him. Well, meanwhile they're being hit by mortars and all kinds of stuff, and Vernon's men keep dying, and he keeps going and taking the dog tags off their necks, and he's got this fist. He's got 17 dog tags finally
of dead comrades.
There's like a half a dozen guys left. He leads them down the hill. And they take out a few more, a tank and a couple of other things on the way down. And Vernon, I said, what happened when you got down the road? He said, yeah. I puked my guts out.
So here Vernon Baker kills 17 Germans, takes out 4 machine gun nests, an observation post, 2 bunkers, and disrupts enemy communications single-handedly, essentially.
That's right. He really did. And the next day, he was, you know, this officer sent him to lead some green guys on a patrol the same place. He didn't want to go, but he had to. And the Germans had pulled out. And I think the reason they pulled out was because he'd wrecked their communications. But all his dead men were scattered every place where they'd fallen. And none of them had shoes or socks. Their boondockers and their socks had all been taken by the retreating Germans.
Wow. His award, his Medal of Honor, came in 1997, 52 years later. Why so long?
Well, it's absolutely just like the same as with the Japanese Americans. There was this discrimination on the part of the military that just felt that black guys and Japanese Americans just weren't tough enough to deserve the medal. And, of course, that was ridiculous. And there came a time when... These records were reviewed, and Vernon got this call out in Idaho from this professor who'd had a grant, and they reviewed a whole bunch of Distinguished Service Crosses from the 92nd Division and others, and seven Medals of Honor were awarded to black guys, and as Vernon said, I was the only one left walking around. Wow. I said to him, "What did you think finally when President Clinton?" Put that medal around your neck, as you know, it hangs from a pink or a sky blue ribbon.
Right.
And it was, you know, there's something else about these guys, Tom, I got to tell you. But I said to Vernon, what was going through his mind? And he said, I was thinking about 19 men left on a hillside. Mm-hmm. And then he started to cry. And I was crying too, you know. I mean,
yeah.
It was
yeah.
a lot of these big, tough, macho guys. You know, they're very much in touch with who they are, and they're not ashamed of expressing themselves
right.
or showing their emotion. Very
right.
often, these guys would come to tears in talking with me.
19 of his comrades left right there. And all these years later, him remembering it that way.
Yeah.
And as we hear these stories tonight, Larry, and of course, you've got stories in here from World War II right through Vietnam, Korea, I hope we get to one of those. I can't help thinking of the soldiers on this Memorial Day who are deployed right now in Iraq. There's been so much focus on the grand strategy of the war and the cause for going in and whether it was right or wrong and weapons of mass destruction and the horrible scenes from Abu Ghraib. But at the same time, there are young American soldiers who are being ordered into all kinds of combat and danger out there. I don't know if we fully are hearing what they're facing yet. Is it the kind of war that produces Medal of Honor winners, what's going on right now in Iraq, or not?
Oh, I think it could certainly happen, but as you know, they come so infrequently. The only Medals of Honor to be awarded since Vietnam were these two guys who went down in Somalia to rescue the Black Hawk pilot and Black Hawk down, Shuhart and Gary Gordon, and they were both killed. And so, I mean, that was an action that occurred in, 15 minutes or an hour. So it could certainly happen in Iraq. But the larger point which you make, I think, is that, no matter how you feel about the politics of the war or who's prosecuting it or what's going on, one of the things, somebody asked me the other day, what did you get out of writing this book? And I said, I got a whole new understanding of the word patriotism. I said I always mistrusted the word because it always seems to be used by some politician trying to manipulate somebody or somebody being bombastic about something. But these kids in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and then in Iraq today are kids who really believe in service to their country. It's no joke. They're not motivated by self-interest. They love their country, and they feel obligated to do something for it, and you got to respect that.
My wife was just in an airport over the weekend and saw a recruit who was headed to Iraq, and she said, he was so young. His skin still looked like child skin, even. Yeah. And yet it's soldiers just that young who are often thrust into the toughest part of battle.
War is terrible, and it's something that's... As the Vietnam guy Jack Jacobs said, this is something to be avoided at all costs. But when the time comes, if you got to serve your country, you got to serve your country. Is the way he put it. And there they go. And as you say, they're just kids. Jesus.
And some come out with levels of courage and valor as the award demands above and beyond the call of duty. We're talking tonight about the Congressional Medal of Honor and the stories of its recipients awarded the Medal for Courage Above and Beyond the Call of Duty. My guest is Larry Smith, author of Beyond Glory, Medal of Honor Heroes in Their Own Words. After the break, we'll hear from Alfred Al Rascone, a medic in the 173rd Airborne, received the Medal of Honor for action in Vietnam. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Congressional Medal of Honor and the stories of its recipients awarded the medal for courage above and beyond the call of duty. My guest has been Larry Smith, joining me from Washington tonight. He's author of Beyond Glory, Medal of Honor Heroes in Their Own Words, the collected stories of 24 Medal of Honor winners. And they are incredible stories. The extent to which these men, and they happen to be men, have gone in battle under all kinds of different circumstances, I have to say, Larry, it just takes your breath away. I want to speak and let all of us hear right now from one of these Medal of Honor winners who spoke with Larry Smith. Al Rascone joins us from Laurel, Maryland. He was a medic in the 173rd Airborne. He received the medal for action on March 16th, 1966 in Vietnam, was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor at the White House by President Clinton in February of 2000. Good evening and welcome, Al Rascone.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Al, we're going to learn about you, but let us learn about you in part through what happened on that day in 1966. Can you tell us the setting and the circumstances of your action on that day?
Well, it's something I guess I live already in my life. It's like 10 minutes or 20 minutes of hell, like I tell everybody. It's just a situation in which I'm barely, I think I just turned 20. And I had been in Vietnam for almost 10 months. And by that time, I'd been injured, I think, three times. And I don't know how many times I had taken care of people and seen my first death, seen my friends, you know, whose lives had been taken. And it started out on a 4 days prior when we came into this area in southern Vietnam, and it was a major operation in which our unit, the 173rd Airborne Brigade, which was an airborne unit. In fact, we were the first Army unit to go to Vietnam in force. Mm-hmm. And that probably the 14th, 15th, up to the 16th, we kept on running into large enemy forces, which were North Vietnamese and South Vietnam in an area called Long Can. And that evening on the 15th, at about 12 o'clock, we ended up getting mortar fire. And it was nothing unusual for us, but at about 6 o'clock the next morning, which was the 16th, mm-hmm. our sister
of March,
battalion,
1966, yeah.
Yes, sir. Our sister battalion, the 2nd 503rd, ended up being surrounded by a North Vietnamese regiment at about 6 o'clock in the morning in an area called Landing Zone Zulu Zulu, approximately 5 or 6 kilometers away from us. And they went at it. I mean, and they went at it dearly and heavily, and you can hear everything that was going on. And probably within 2 hours, they started committing elements from the 1st Battalion, our battalion, in to help them.
Right.
And then probably by 12 o'clock, they ended up committing the rest of the forces, and my platoon was a reconnaissance platoon, which we had been from the get-go. And I was the only medic with them and had been the only medic with them. Mm-hmm. And we were the point element to go to them. And this is a situation where, you know, I've been in firefights before, and you go help your friends, and most of the time you get there as best as you can. There's nothing much of a hurry, but this one's like hurry up and run. And you're running, and it got pretty intensive there. And about more than 200 meters away until we got there, we started running into enemy dead. One, two, or three that were laying on the road or laying off the trails, and you could hear this huge firefight that was going on someplace to our front.
And it wasn't long before you were hit yourself.
Well, eventually what happens, probably about a half an hour before we got to that unit, our point squad leader by the name of Ray Compton stops everybody and he says, I've got North Vietnamese to the front, and they're setting up an L-shaped ambush. And the platoon sergeant, immediately at that time, they make a decision to take them on. And that was it. I mean, everything broke loose. I'm talking about the kitchen sink. And probably within the first 2 minutes, I ended up with somebody being up in the front being hit. I had no idea who it was. And, again, you're a medic, and that's what you're there to do. You're there to take care of your friends. And
to go to them wherever they are. And take us then, is this the 15 minutes of hell that ended up putting you in line for Medal of Honor, Alan? And how? Why?
Well, I mean, according to what they claim that I did, and again, I claim I was just doing my job, and that's the thing that I've always done. And they claim that I went mm-hmm. up to the front and went up on an enemy trail, took out one of my comrades who was injured, and I covered him with my body, intentionally put my body to the enemy fire, and was hit by enemy grenades, hit in the hip, came out of my spine, mm-hmm. took him off the trail, went back and helped another machine gunner who was being injured. Went back and took machine gun ammunition from the person I had just rolled off the hill. Went back and I took care of another individual. Apparently went back on the enemy trail to retrieve the machine gun, the ammunition, and spare barrels. And I was hit twice by that time. And someplace in between that firefight, there were two individuals. One was up to the front, further soldier up to the front by the name of Neil Haffey, who had just seen his best friend killed. Mm-hmm. And I saw him get shot in the back, and he was trying to come forward back to his friend. And as I went up to him to try to help him, he was they threw, I think, two or three hand grenades at him. And I threw myself on him trying to save his life, and we both ended up on the short end of the stick, as I tell people. We both ended up getting hit, and took him off the trail, took care of him, and it was hit.
It's unbelievable. Larry Smith, what in this story, from all the Medal of Honor stories that you've heard, stands out, this story of Al Rascone in Vietnam, 1966?
Well, the thing that you know, you can see between the lines here is that First of all, you should know that Al Rascón has been troubled painfully his entire life by these injuries. He's about to have a knee replacement from part of all that, and he lives in constant pain, which I wouldn't call it terrible because he wouldn't like that word, but he's had a really, really hard time with that. The thing that I admire about Al isn't has nothing to do with his stature or he likes to call himself Pee-wee, but the fact that he kept going back, and he's wounded, he's hurt, he's this machine gunner on the trail that he covers. This guy's on the verge of death, and Al's lying between him and the guys firing behind him, and that's just for openers. In other words, you can see that if Al had been killed there, it wouldn't have made it. He would have kept right on going until he was killed. And no, he's giving no thought to his own well-being or safety or anything. He's just trying to help these guys because they're his friends, but more because it's his job.
Al Rascón, when you think back on that day, can you remember all of these details, or were you in a frenzy? Can you pick through the details of memory, the details of each of these events even now, or is it a blur?
You know, I remember things very distinctly, and other things are just blurred. And then there's some idiotic things that occur. I remember that when I was hit in the face, I thought my face was gone. And I stopped, and I started to think about, gee, you know, my good looks are gone.
Yeah.
It's just these crazy things. And then everything goes into slow motion. I remember the yelling, a lot of yelling. I remember people, both the Vietnamese yelling, us yelling. And I remember people trying to say, cover Doc, cover Doc. And I think that's probably the most notable thing about this thing, that people don't realize that it's kill or get killed. But again, country, yes, but it's more of you're there for your friend.
Whether it's Vietnam or, I suppose, today in Iraq, Al.
That's true, because I just finished serving 4.5 months in Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm still a reservist, if you can believe that.
Wow.
And I just came back from, I was in December and January, I was up with 101st Airborne in Iraq. But I do this because, you know, I love the military from the get-go. I'm an immigrant to this country, and like I tell people, Mexican by birth, American by choice.
Al Rascón, Medal of Honor winner for service above and beyond the call of duty in March of 1966, awarded in February of 2000. Al Rascón, thank you very much for being with us and sharing your story tonight.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. And Larry Smith, thank you for collecting all of these stories. It's a remarkable series of insights into human beings in terrible circumstances. Nobody would call them otherwise.
Tom, Al became a citizen a year after he got his medal.
Amazing. It's humbling. It's good to remember. Good reason not to go to war unless we have to. Good reason to honor the men and women who do what has to be done once they're there. Larry Smith, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom. It's a good thing you're doing.
Larry Smith, author of Beyond Glory, Medal of Honor Heroes in Their Own Words. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a first-hand account of Marine bravery in Iraq. This is On Point. There are many different kinds of bravery being demonstrated right now in Iraq and Afghanistan. Army Specialist Joe Darby, who reported the abuse and torture of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, showed special courage in the act of coming forward while so many others stayed silent. And then there is the day-in and day-out patrol and combat courage of American soldiers trying to carry out American policy, as ordered, in dangerous, complex circumstances. Over 800 U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq and 85 more in Afghanistan. Robert Kaplan is a writer for the Atlantic Monthly magazine. He was with the U.S. Marines in Iraq when they pushed into Fallujah last month. Here, Robert Kaplan reads from his own account of that push, a passage where Marines under Captain Jason Smith were positioned near the main thruway dividing North and South Fallujah, a thruway renamed Michigan by American troops. His full account will appear in the July-August edition of The Atlantic.
I had just poured water into the heating filter for a Captain Country Chicken MRE and was preparing to remove some layers of clothing beneath my flak vest, for the weather had turned hot after the freezing night, when RPG and small arms fire rattled the scrap iron that formed the roof of the filthy garage headquarters. The fire directed at us did not let up. Over the ICOM, Smith learned that it was coming from a mosque on Michigan, about 300 yards away. The mosque was promptly targeted for a possible airstrike, and everyone began a fast march toward it. Smith did not have to order his Marines straight into the direction of the fire. It was a collective impulse, a phenomenon I would see again and again over the coming days. The idea that Marines are trained to break down doors, to seize beachheads, and other territory was an abstraction until I was there to experience it. Running into fire rather than seeking cover from it goes counter to every human survival instinct. Trust me. I was sweating as much from fear as from the layers of clothing I still had on from the night before, to the degree that it felt as if pure salt were running into my eyes from my forehead. As the weeks had rolled on, and I had gotten to know the 1-5 Marines as the individuals they were, I had started deluding myself that they weren't much different from me. They had soft spots. They got sick. They complained. But in one flash, as we charged across Michigan amid whistling incoming shots, I realized that they were not like me. They were Marines. We ran through several residential lots until we were just outside the gates of the mosque. It had a Persian-style blue dome, though it was Sunni. Then the firing stopped. One of Smith's corporals, Robert Dawson of Staten Island, led an assault squad of 9 Marines into the mosque. His men detained 2 people and found some arms, but most of the gunmen, whom local kids called Ali Babas, had fled just as the Marines were closing in on it. Directly across the street from the mosque was an apartment building that the Marines had suspected was used to fire on them. Consequently, they had searched it and had ordered a large family with children and babies into the courtyard. Captain Smith approached the male head of the family to apologize and stood erect except for a slight hunch in his shoulders, his hands deep in his pockets, a position I would see him take often when he was deciding, thinking, or about to say something important. He stared unblinking at the man. It was sometimes hard to imagine anyone more serious and intense than Captain Jason Smith. Yet there was a courtly quality about him, too. I thought of a Confederate officer. Through his Iraqi interpreter, Smith told the man, "Sir, we are truly sorry that we had to ask your family to leave the building. You can all go back in now. We will compensate you for the inconvenience. We are United States Marines, a different breed than you are used to. We do not take kindly to people shooting at us. If you have any information about the Ali Babas, please share it with us. If you know any of the Ali Babas personally, please tell them to attack us as quickly as possible so that we may kill them and start repairing sewers, electricity, and other services in your city." After the translation was complete, the man, looking dumbfounded, gripped Smith's hand and wouldn't let it go.
Robert Kaplan is a writer for the Atlantic Monthly. His first-hand account of the Marine Corps push into Fallujah will appear in the July-August edition of the magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.